the Shramanya Pala Sutta in Pali, or Samanya Pala Sutta in Sanskrit, or Samanya Pala Sutta in Pali. Last week we discussed the organization and redaction process of the canon as a whole, and sort of give some thought to why particular suttas end up in particular places and why things are organized the way that they are. And so we suggested that the chapter that we're concerned with at the moment, this Hilakanda Vagga, was originally part of it is a Samyutta style collection of texts all dealing with the same topic, and perhaps was originally part of a larger group of similar texts organized in a similar way when the canon was organized according to Angas. And I also suggested that the Digha Nikaya was partly created, or Digha Agama was created, one of the cause of it was this chapter with about 12 or 13 suttas dealing with the gradual training. And I also suggested that the reason why the Theravadan tradition in particular put this sutta and the Brahmajala sutta at the beginning of the canon was possibly as a result of the influence of the Third Council under King Ashoka. That's why it's there in the Theravadan school, but in the other schools has a different sequence. And one thing I should also mention, I think I forgot to mention last week, was that according to some sources, which I forget right at the moment, I believe it may be a Sangha, the purpose or the primary purpose of the Digha Agama or Digha Agama or Digha Nikaya is conversion, and as teachings for non-Buddhists. And so that's actually borne out quite nicely in the collection as we have it, because most of the suttas in the Digha are actually discussions with non-Buddhists, particularly with Brahmins and other influential people, such as, of course, King Ajatasattu, the king of Magadha. This particular discourse we have called the Samanya Pala Sutta, the Samanya Pala Sutta, a Pali version of it, is the title of the sutta. Pala in Sanskrit. So fruit is obviously fruit means fruit, obviously. Pala means fruit, and used in a literal sense as well as in an applied sense as here. And the first element here, just to give explanation just so that I don't get confused about this, but it's derived from the word samana. Samana. And in Pali, this is the noun form, samana, meaning an ascetic or one who's gone forth or something like that. And in the noun form, in Pali, in order to create an abstract noun out of an ordinary noun, then you have to add a long A in the first syllable and add a YA in the last syllable. So giving us samanya. So this is the abstract noun. So this is, if we translate samana as ascetic, then this would be translated as asceticism. If we translate samana as recluse, samanya is recluseship. You can see the formation of the word more clearly in the Sanskrit form here. The YA at the end here is still evident. In the Pali, that's been assimilated to form nya, it's pronounced the same. And the A here becomes it's not an added long A, it's an added a short A. And that's in the long A in the first syllable of the word. So that the Y gets added at the end, and the A gets added in the first syllable. Okay? So that's why the abstract noun is samanya, reclusive. Does that make sense?
Where does that A get added?
First syllable. It's the first vowel.
It becomes long.
It becomes long, yeah. One two short A's equals one long A.
Why doesn't mean the dot is two N's?
Yeah, exactly, which is how it's pronounced anyway. Yeah. You have similar changes. We don't need to go into too much detail here. Those of you in the Pali class will get familiar with these kinds of changes quite quickly, but I just mention it so that you understand what the difference is. But you do find similar kinds of changes in English as well. For example, the difference between child and children is very similar. To get from child to children, you add an ending, run, and you subtract a short A from the first syllable. So child is chai, is a diphthong with a short A and a short E sound. Chai, child. And if you take away the short A, you get a child. Yeah. Which obviously you're not going to be if there's lots of children, so that's why you have to take away. Okay. Enough Pali for now. Okay, so Samanya Pala Sutta, and of course the meaning of it, meaning of Samana is referring to the ascetic life and the monastic life as recognized in ancient India and practiced there long before the Buddha. As we're all familiar, that there's this basic distinction in Indian religious life between Brahmins and the ascetics, and we find this compound again and again and again, Samana Brahmana, the Samanas and ascetics. And in Panini's Sanskrit grammar, these are given as examples of things which are in constant conflict. Samanas and Brahmins. Two things in constant conflict. Before the Buddha, and again I won't go too much into the history, we discussed these in the history class last year, but we have the Jains and the Ajivikas, and also the Shramana movements. And anyone who's interested in these, just a few good books on that. Instead of Jainism, Jain Agams. So notice they use the same word, Agama, for their texts. And this is about the only book ever written on the Ajivikas, and written by A.L. Basham, who incidentally was the head of Buddhist scholarship and more or less the founder and so on of Buddhist scholarship at the ANU for many years. And he wrote this book which assembles more or less all of the existing information which we have about the Ajivikas, which is not much, and does quite a remarkable job of assembling it all and analysing and drawing out what information we have, including, of course, the evidence of the sutta that we're going to deal with right now, which is one of the major source works. So here's the history and doctrines of the Ajivikas. Do yourself a favour. Right, so that's show and tell part of the class is over. Now here we have in front of us the table of correspondences for the Samanyapala Sutta. And as you can see, quite a few, an impressive body of parallels. Here's our one. Samanyapala, what do these numbers here signify? Sorry? Yeah, but exactly what? 47 watts. If only it was. If only if it was the 47th paragraph, then I would be a happy man. But no, it's the 47th page. Volume 1, 47th page. And this is the standard way of referencing books in Pali, and the standard academic referencing is by the volume and page number of the Pali Text Society edition, which is an appalling way of doing referencing. Nevertheless, it has been the standard. It should, of course, be done according to a chapter and verse system like the Bible, but so far there's no standardized system. These fellows, the World Tripitaka Mob, have developed a chapter and verse system. As you see, each paragraph is numbered, but it's not been adopted widely. They're just made up by the translator.
Oh, so the English has the Czech
No. That's right. When they did the translations, they broke it up into paragraphs and numbered the paragraphs. Now, in many cases, the way of doing that is pretty obvious, and in many cases, the actual paragraphs would in fact correspond with paragraphs in the Pali Text Society edition. Okay, but that's not used as a numbering system, so that's got nothing to do with that numbering. That's only the page number. All right.
The number of one
is volume one. This is the volume and page number. Volume 1, page 47, exactly.
Why not just say page number 2?
You can. That's another way of referencing it. So on Sutta Central, we gave both kinds of references.
In the Pali, so the numbering of the sutta is Pali, the numbering of the sutta in Pali and English.
They are usually the same, yeah, except there were some differences in the editing with the minor suttas, none of the Digha or Majjhima, but in the Samyutta, there's some problems with the editing, and so the numbering in Bhikkhu Bodhi's Samyutta translation is in some cases different from the Pali Text Society edition. Yeah, but only in a few cases, just because it's hard to count the repetition sometimes. But that's just important. If you're looking for it, yes, you can look under either DN2 or under DN147. The advantage of having the page and volume reference system is that it's more universal. You can then reference the Vinaya or different suttas and so on the same way, and you can also reference with a bit more refinement inside suttas. But it's still fairly crude because, you know, obviously if you want to reference a word, you've got a whole page of Pali there, you have to look through to find a word. Then you're, yes. And they're not assuming that, but that's just become the academic convention. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure on that. You might find it's inconsistent in the. I know in the Sanyukta Agama, in the Agamas in Chinese, in the Taisho anyway, they're numbered, but not 100% consistently. I think they are numbered there consistently, but they're not titled consistently. I guess most likely in the actual manuscripts they're probably not numbered. They would often be given a title which is found in the large suttas, maybe at the end of the sutta, or else a bunch of keywords which are found at the end of a chapter, a wagga of 10. That's actually where most of the titles for our suttas come from. They're not actually titles in the text themselves, they're keywords at the end of the chapter. So the modern editors have inferred a title from those.
So, apart from Sutta Central,
yeah.
Is there any other kind of reference that you can mesh? If I'm looking for something like people number being 147,
yeah.
Apart from Sutta Central, is there something else that I know what I can get from you?
I don't know of anywhere that collects all those. I mean, they're more or less kind of understood. There's a few places which you can probably find online where they have a list of conventions. You see where the abbreviations, because the abbreviations are not always consistent. Different people use them differently. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure if there is anywhere. That's right, yeah, that's one of the decisions that we made. So in each sutta, we have the sutta number and the Pali Text Society reference. Yeah. Alright. So, as you can see from here, obviously a whole bunch of corresponding passages, and as usual, that has significance in itself. It tells us it was a very popular text, and a very popular story, and very widely distributed among the schools. Now, these particular corresponding ones, just to run through them briefly, this one, DA27, obviously the 27th sutta in the Dirgha Agama of the Dharmaguptaka school, translated into Chinese by Buddhaya Shas. The T22, Taisho number 22. This is Taisho Sutra number 22. And I should say here that there's a similar numbering convention here. This is a sutra number, Taisho Sutra number 22. This is a Taisho volume and page number. Okay. So if you're looking for this either in the hard copy of the Taisho Canon or else on the C-Beta version, you can look at it. Probably the quickest, most accurate way is to just put the volume page number in. So this is an independent Diga-style sutta in the Taisho Canon. I don't know where the translator's from or anything. Another version in the Ekotara Agama, translated by Gautama Sangadeva and suggested to be of the Mahasanghika school. A version in the Sangyukta Agama, 154-163, partial parallel, it says here. And so this is the sutra on the four fruits. No, that's not four fruits, is it? That's the 14. What's that doing? What does it say? Yeah? Is that Ashoka? We should. It's not the way that they spell Ashoka in Chinese, is it? No. Anyway, this is in a section in the Sangyukta Agama. I'm not 100%, this may be in the section of the Sangyukta Agama which is actually a chapter of the life of King Ashoka. That's why I asked that. It may not actually belong intrinsically to the text, but as part of the text it's being put in there artificially. I'm not 100% sure on that. I'd have to check that one out. These two are in two of the Vinayas. These are the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, is that right? Yep. And so two partial correspondences in the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya. The story is told twice. And this one also Mulasarvastivada Vinaya. So are these Mulasarvastivada? Yeah, it is. That's the root, isn't it? It's the Mula bit. That's what I tell. This that's the Mula bit. It's true. It looks like a tree, yeah? And it's got its roots going down, yeah? So that's the Mula Sarvastivada bit. And here in the Sangha Bhedat Vastu, this is one of the versions of the Buddha biography, which is found in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. So it's found there once more. So this is probably similar to one of those Chinese texts there. Another Sanskrit fragment, blah, blah. Another Sanskrit fragment, blah, blah, from Turpan. And another one, translation. And here also is the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya in Tibetan translation. So you can see why the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya is very useful for historical scholarship, because it's one of the few texts that because it's so large, it can contain so many different kinds of things, and it's because it's so widely distributed across the versions in Chinese, Tibetan, and Sanskrit. So it's very useful for scholars. So now, of these different versions, you notice that quite a few of them have an asterisk next to them, and that means a partial correspondence. And we'll have a bit later at what are some of the similarities and differences between the different versions. But one of the main things that we'll notice when we're reading this sutta is that there's really two major sections to it. One is the actual story with King Ajatasattu and the dialogue with him, and then the other is the section on the threefold training. The section on the threefold training, as I mentioned before, is common across all the suttas in that chapter, so it's not really an intrinsic part of this sutta at all. And so it really depends on what the priorities of the presenter are. If somebody's particularly interested in presenting the whole of the training and so on, they'll include that part. But if they're mainly focusing on the biographical story and the narrative section, then that part can be left out, and just to focus on the tale of King Ajatasattu. Right? Now, as far as resources for this particular study of this particular sutta go in print, then the best one, of course, is Bhikkhu Bodhi's The Discourse on the Fruits of Recluseship. And the only flaw with the whole book is his choice of the word recluseship for samanya, Buddhist hybrid English. But as Maurice Walsh points out in his translation, samana doesn't really mean recluse at all. It means ascetic. It's from the root shram, to weary oneself. So it should be the fruits of asceticism, would be a better translation. So this has not only, of course, Bhikkhu Bodhi's excellent introductory essay, but the whole sutta translated and the bulk of the commentary, and the sub-commentary and the new sub-commentary translated. Not all of them, but the bulk of them. And this is... These works, a series of works by Bhikkhu Bodhi, are one of the few attempts to actually translate significant quantities of the commentarial and sub-commentarial literature into English. And so this gives you a good example of the both the strengths and weaknesses of the commentarial literature. But certainly much of the material here is actually very useful in the commentary, so that's highly recommended. We'll be using that as these series of talks progress. So what I might do now is, before going on to the sutta as such, I might read the introduction to the sutta, week 3 through the introduction to the sutta by T.W. Rhys-Davies. And this is taken from his translation of the Digha Nikaya, which I believe we have downstairs. And again, anybody who's interested, that's an excellent work, and was one of the foundational works in modern Buddhist studies. Rhys Davies's work, of course, is outdated now. It's nearly 100 years later. But he still has a lot of very, very interesting reflections. There are still very few scholars who have as broad a grasp of Indian culture and life as he did. And it's very interesting also because his renderings and translations were extremely influential in his day. He was one of the leading intellectuals in England in his time, the first part of the 20th century. And he was the one who, more than anyone else, put Buddhism on the map as far as the intellectual life of our culture. And many of the ideas and words that we use in Buddhism today were coined and originally introduced by T.W. Rhys-Davies, so it's worthwhile getting used to his, getting some idea of what he was saying. The most obvious example is mindfulness. Okay, the word mindfulness was first used as a rendering of sati by T.W. Rhys-Davies. So obviously being a very successful rendering, and one which, in a sense, is, you know, you think back, he's translating it at a time when there's not even the faintest idea of a meditative culture in England. You know, you're talking England in the late 19th century, early 20th century. They haven't got a clue what meditation is. Rhys Davies has been in Sri Lanka, and he's met Sri Lankan monks and so on, but there's very little meditation going on there either. And so yet he still manages to have an insight into the meaning of the word, so that it's still like a buzzword for psychologists and philosophers today. Okay. So, and Rhys Davies is especially useful for his remarks on the background and the social context in which suttas are given. Okay, so I'll just read through his introduction here. The first dialogue deals with, this was the Brahmajala Sutta, the previous one, deals with the most fundamental conceptions that lay at the root of the Buddha's doctrine, his dharma, his ethical and philosophical view of life. The second puts forth his justification for the foundation of, for the order, for the enunciation of the Vinaya, the practical rules of canon law by which life in the order is regulated. The rules themselves are not discussed. It is only certain ethical precepts that are referred to in so many words. The question is a larger and wider one than the desirability of any particular injunction. It is as to the advantage, as to the use of having any order at all, any sangha at all. King Ajatasattu of Magadha after pointing out the advantages derived from their occupations by a long list of ordinary people in the world, asks whether the members of the Sangha who have given up the world derive any corresponding advantage visible in this life from theirs. The answer is a list of such advantages arranged in a descending and an ascending scale of importance, each one mentioned being said to be better and sweeter than the one just before described. The list of ordinary occupations given in the question is interesting evidence, especially as compared with the later lists of a similar kind referred to in the notes of social conditions in the Ganges Valley at the time when this dialogue was composed, and the introductory story in which the king explains how he put a similar question to the founders of six other orders and gives the six replies he received is interesting evidence of the views held by the authors of the dialogue as to beliefs current at the time. Okay, so two kinds of information which Rhys Davids is pointing to we have here. One is information about social conditions in the Ganges Valley, and the other is the views of the other ascetics at the time. And notice that Rhys Davids is very careful to say it's the views that the authors of the sutta hold about the beliefs current at the time. The replies are no less interesting from the fact pointed out by the king that they are not to the point. Each of the six teachers goes off into a general statement of his theory instead of answering the question put. But as the works, if any, of all these teachers, save one, Nigantanathaputta, of course the founder of the Jains, have been irretrievably lost, the summary here given of their doctrines is of great importance as evidence of the sort of speculation they favoured. The six paragraphs are short and obscure, and this is just what we should expect, as is the case with the accounts given by early Catholic writers of opinions they held to be heretical. The versions of these six sets of beliefs are neither adequate nor clear, but a number of other references to these six theories are found, as pointed out in the notes, both in the Buddhist and the Jain records. And it would be premature to discuss our six paragraphs until the whole of this available evidence is made accessible to scholars. And of course, much of that has been made available since Rhys Davids' time. It's noteworthy that in at least two of these answers, some of the expressions used seem to be in a Prakrit, differing in dialect from the Pali of the Pitakas. And these are not the only instances of the preservation in the Pitakas of ancient dialectical varieties. Okay, so another point which has been amplified and confirmed by later linguistic research, that there are non-Pali forms, sometimes referred to as Magadhan forms, found in some of these particular passages. The answer which the king is represented to have given in his turn to the question raised by the king, the answer which the Buddha is represented to have given to the question raised by the king takes, as is so often the case, the form of a counter-question. And so notice that this dialogue is a vyakarana, and we discussed last week the idea of the angas and the idea that one of the major types of Buddhist literature was the question and answer format. And the question is, the very man whom under ordinary circumstances you would treat as a slave or a servant, what treatment would you mete out to him after he had joined an order? The king confesses that he would treat him as a person worthy of honour and respect, and neither in question nor answer is there any reference specially to the Buddhist order. It is taken for granted, alike by the Buddha and the king, that anyone who had devoted himself to the religious life, whatever the views or opinions he held, or the association he had joined, would, in accordance with the remarkable tolerance of that age and country, be treated with equal respect and courtesy. And the same note runs through all the dialogue. The Buddha shows the advantages of the life of a recluse, not necessarily of a follower of his own. And most of what he says would apply as much to his strongest opponents as to the members of his own order. The following, in a constantly ascending order of merit, are the advantages visible in this life which he claims for such a recluse. And so here's more or less a summary of the main content of the suttas. First of all, the honour and respect shown to a member of religious order, the training all those lower kinds of mere morality set out in a very ancient document called the Silas. So this document we're reading wasn't encoded in Unicode, so the symbols aren't showing up properly. So the Silas, the importance of this document has been discussed above in the introduction to the Brahmajala, and we'll be looking in more detail at this later on. And the mercy and kindness to all living beings, honesty, chastity, truthfulness, abstinence, not injuring plants, not laying up treasure, not frequenting shows, not playing games, using luxurious rugs, not using toilet luxuries, vain talk, sophistical and rude phrases when speaking of higher things, acting as go-between, not practicing trickery and mystery under the guise of religion, not gaining a living by low arts. Then going on to the confidence of heart and absence of fear resulting from the consciousness of right doing, the habit of keeping guarded the door of the senses, the constant self-possession he thus gained, the power of being content with little, the emancipation of heart from the five hindrances, the joy and the peace that fills him, and then the four jhanas, the insight rising from knowledge, power of projecting mental images, astral projection, five modes of mystic insight, he translates, abhinya, and the realization of the four truths and the attainment of arahantship. Now, it goes on, it's perfectly true that of these 13 consecutive propositions or groups of propositions, it is only the last which is exclusively Buddhist. But the things omitted, the union of the whole of these included into one system, the order in which the ideas are arranged, the way in which they are treated as so many steps of a ladder whose chief value depends on the fact that it leads up to the culminating point of nirvana in arahantship, all this is also distinctively Buddhist. Okay, so that's a very important statement, and I think a very accurate description of this, that there's all of those things, except for the notion of the Four Noble Truths, all of those things would be found in other religious systems. But the way that it's all put together is very distinctively Buddhist. And particularly, notice what he said here, the things omitted. Okay? This being one of the remarkable features of the Buddhist text is how much it is just ignored. Such as worship of deities, performance of rituals, all of these things, which is the actual kind of the main bulk of the religious life in ancient India. That's what a lot of the other ascetics are spending all their time doing, their ascetic practices and everything. And the Buddha just ignores the whole lot of it. Yeah. Well, I mean, some of them are found under the sealers, the things to be avoided, but there's also a lot of things that are just not there. And further, the whole statement, the details of it, the order of it, must have soaked very thoroughly into the minds of the early Buddhists before we find the whole, or nearly the whole of it, repeated with direct reference by name to our sutta as the oldest and most complete enumeration of it, not only in all the subsequent dialogues translated in this volume, but also in many others. In these repetitions, the order is always the same, and the details, so far as they occur, are the same, but one or other of the 13 groups is often omitted, and the application of those that remain is always different. That is to say, they're enumerated in support or an illustration of a different proposition. This particular part of Rhys Davids' argument is not quite correct. Because the Samanipala Sutta came number 2 in the Pali, and because it's the subsequent Pali discourses usually abbreviate a lot of the material, and in the Pali text itself it'll say all of this should be expanded as in the Samanipala Sutta. Okay, so if you're reading the Pali manuscript, when you get to Digha Nikaya number 7, for example, you'll get to a bit, it'll abbreviate and it'll say expand everything as in the Samanipala Sutta. Okay, so they're constantly referring back to the Samanipala Sutta. So he assumes, and this was an assumption made in earlier Buddhist studies, that suggests that Samanipala Sutta itself is the earliest version of this. But in fact, that's a false assumption, which we know from the comparison with Chinese and Sanskrit and so on, that the fact that it's number 2 in the Digha is purely a characteristic of the Theravadin school. And that there's no particular reason to think that it's earlier than the other suttas of a similar nature. Okay. A comparison of some of these other applications of this list is full of suggestions as to its real meaning here. So here is having a look at some of the other suttas in the Digha Nikaya, which have the same passage on the threefold training, but they apply it in some slightly different ways. In the Ambatta Sutta, the point is as to caste. The Kshatriya caste is the most honourable. But wisdom and conduct are higher still. What then is the right conduct? What the right wisdom? The conduct, the charana, of all other paragraphs is the training up to and including the four jhanas, and the wisdom is the rest, the various kinds of psychic powers and arahantship. In the Sovanadanda Sutta, the question is, what is the true Brahman? After, by his usual Socratic method, leading Sovanadanda to acknowledge that the only two essential requisites are goodness and intelligence, these last are explained as above. So Rhys Davids here, his aside, saying the Buddha's usual Socratic method, I think certainly the Buddha is using a Socratic method here. Wouldn't quite be so forward as to say it's a usual method. It's one which is found in a number of suttas, but it's not as characteristic of the Buddha as it was of Socrates. Does anyone know what he's meaning when he's saying Socratic method here? Questions? More specifically? Any kind of questions? What kind of questions?
Rather than trying to lead to the answer through questions, that's not all there is to it, though. There's a little bit more to it.
Now we might discuss the Socratic method a little bit more when we look at the Milindapanha, which I think is Thursday. But one of the things, Socrates believed that everybody knew everything. So he believed that the person he was talking with actually had lived so many lives and they'd learned all the knowledge that they needed to know in all of their past lives. And so in order to find the truth, you didn't have to show or demonstrate the truth to them. What you had to do is to tease out the knowledge that they already had, but that they'd forgotten. So the Socratic method specifically is a way of taking someone from their own position, their own set of tenets and ideas, and leading them towards implications of those ideas which they hadn't thought through and which they weren't aware of. Okay? So that's really the essence of the Socratic method. So this is what is done in suttas like the Sovanadanda Sutta. And assumes his interlocutor's position and then leads him step by step. He does, but in Socrates, it's almost all he does, whereas the Buddha, it's what he does in certain contexts. Yeah. So. Yeah. Exactly, and I think that's a different assumption. Yeah, Socrates basically assumed everyone knew everything. The Buddha didn't make that assumption. In the Kutadanta Sutta, the question is the right sort of sacrifice. After rejecting animal sacrifice, you have generosity of various kinds, each better than the last. Faith, training in the precepts, and the sections 2 to 13 set forth as each of them a better sacrifice than the last. Okay, so that's a rephrasing of the Buddha's teachings as being the highest sort of form of sacrifice. In the Jalaya Sutta, the question is whether the soul is the same as or is other than the body. The answer is a counter question. Repeating our sections 2 to 13, the Buddha asks at the end of each subdivision whether men who would do that would be likely to trouble themselves as to speculations about the soul. The answer being, of course, no, rejoins that neither does he. In the Potapada Sutta, the question is as to the way in which the various recluses attain to mystic trance, samadhi. The Buddha's answer is by training, and the training should be in first of the various kinds of groups in the gradual training, but also including the four formless attainments. And then the dialogue takes up other questions omitting our groups 10 to 13. So a little bit different. In the Kevada Sutta, the talk is on miracles and mystic powers. The Buddha, disparaging all others, calls attention to our groups 12 to 2 to 13. In the Lohicha Sutta, the question is as to the right sort of teacher, and of course the pupil who does the gradual training. In the Tevijja, the question is the way that one can attain to union with God, with Brahma. This is a controversial translation that Rhys Davids used, Brahma Sahavyata. He's translated as union with God or union with Brahma. Actually, it means more companionship with Brahma. So, of course, being quite a different conception of what it's actually about. Does it mean becoming one with the Godhead? Or does it mean going to a heaven where you'll share the heaven with that Brahma god? So the word sahavyata is more literally would be translated as companionship. Yeah, it certainly doesn't. It doesn't. It could be to merge with, but it doesn't specify that. Yeah. And this in the Hatikadokama Suttas, the question is between a Brahmin and ascetic as to the ascendancy of the Buddha over the other teachers at the time. In the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta, Majjhima 38, the same sentence, blah blah blah, and the Mahasapura Sutta, and so on. Okay, what is a true Brahmana and a true Samana? Again, Sakladai Sutta. Okay, besides the differences pointed out between the suttas preserved in the Diga and the Majjhima respectively, differences due, I think, solely to the differences in the subjects under discussion. There are also a few verbal differences amounting to scarcely more than various readings due perhaps to the divergent traditions of the Diga Bhānikas and the Majjhima Bhānikas, the students and repeaters of the two collections in which the dialogues are handed down to us. Okay, so this term Bhānika, which you can't read there because the diacriticals aren't working. Okay, so this is the word that's used in the commentaries to describe the reciters. So you'd have the Diga. Diga Bhānikas and the Majjhima Bhānikas and so on and so forth. And so they're the reciters of the different Nikayas and so on. However this may be, it's clear that the sum and sequence of the paragraphs in our sutta is regarded as of great importance, not as a statement of Buddhist ethics or of Buddhist philosophy or of the Buddhist religion, but as a statement of the advantages that may be looked for as the result of life in an order, in a sangha. And further, that the statement has to be slightly modified and shortened when the question is one, is a narrower one of life in the particular community which we call the Buddhist sangha. The difference is interesting in the scheme for the Buddhist order, by which he's meaning the Buddhist sangha, the jnana dasana, the power of projecting a mental image, apparently of oneself, which seems like the earliest germ of the modern yoga ideas about the astral body. Remembering in Rhys David's era, that was the time when all of these kind of mystical ideas were very popular in English society. You had the Theosophical Society, you had all of these Madame Blavatsky and all these psychics and seers and channelers and everything, and all these kind of teachings on esoteric Buddhism, just as today you find a similar kind of difference between the scholarly approach to Buddhism and then the kind of New Age kind of teachings. And so Rhys Davis was not particularly impressed with all of those New Age teachings. He made one comment on esoteric Buddhism. He said so-called esoteric Buddhism is neither esoteric nor is it Buddhism. He said it's not esoteric because all of the works that it's based on are actually published, and it's not Buddhism. And insofar as it's actually Indian at all, it's Hindu rather than Buddhist, but most of it's actually made up by the Western interpreters. So, Jnanadasana, which seems like the earliest germ of the modern yoga ideas about the astral bodies, the powers of iddhi, psychic simple powers, hearing heavenly sounds, the power of knowing the thoughts of others, are all omitted. So he's making the suggestion that these particular advantages of the holy life are only mentioned when the discourse is given to non-Buddhists. And when the discourse is given to the Sangha for its own purposes, that these things are omitted. Okay? Now that's that thesis there. It'd be worth checking that out in more detail, especially with comparative study. I haven't done that, but it's an interesting proposition. Okay, so these are typically known as the five abhinyas, and a very common group, the chalabhinya, the arahant has six abhinyas, or without arahantship, the five abhinyas, but these are not called so in our text or in any other sutta yet published. So he's making the point that we use the term the five abhinyas and so on, but it's not always used in the text itself. It's more of a commentarial term. I can't remember if it's actually used anywhere in the suttas, but in any case, that's the just a point about terminology. Abhinya, yeah, so the abhinyas are the... Yes, except usually it's these two are kind of extra. So these two are kind of found only in these long Diga versions, and the normal five Abhinyas are here, the psychic powers, heaven, ear, knowledge of others' thoughts, memory of past lives, and knowledge of others' previous births. So that's the five Abhinyas, and obviously together with the realization of arahantship is the six Abhinya, Chalabhinya. And the last three, knowing your past lives, knowing of others' births, actually that shouldn't be previous births, it means knowing of others' course of rebirth, and arahantship, these are the te vidya, the three knowledges. Right. Divine eye is here, knowledge, this is here, the number E. Alright. So the point he's making here is simply that the technical term abhinya as a title for this group is not found in the sutta itself, and generally is not found in the suttas. The group itself, of course, is found. Okay, so just a point on his method here by comparing the usage of this passage here as to all of the other suttas, or many of the other suttas in which it occurs, and that's only a partial collection of them. Then he's making the point that this is not just a kind of a one-off teaching to one person at one time, but is in fact a central teaching on the Buddhist holy life. So again, just to notice this way of reading the suttas, where the significance of a particular passage or a particular sutta can't be understood in isolation, but must be understood in terms of how it's treated in various different kind of contexts. Okay, it's essential in order to understand Buddhist ethics to bear in mind that there are and must be in such a system several different lines along which both speculation and edifying teaching run. These are the course of conduct laid down for ordinary Buddhist laymen contained in the Gathapati Vaggas found in the various Nikayas. The rules as to the outward conduct of the members of the order laid down in the Patimokkha and the Khandakas. The system of self-training and higher things prescribed for members of the order of this, our present sutta, is a striking example. The method of self-training laid down for those who have entered the path to arahantship. In the first of these, Buddhism goes very little beyond the current ethics of the day. Okay, so in other words, the lay ethics is more or less the ethics that was common in India at the time. In the second, which is the Vinayapitaka, of course, a very great deal has been simply incorporated from the rules found expedient by previous recluses, both Brahman and non-Brahman, though there are numerous differences, both of the positive regulations included and also of things deliberately omitted. Even the third, which is the gradual training that we have here, as we've seen, cannot be considered except in a very limited sense as exclusively Buddhist. It is in the fourth that the essential doctrines of Buddhism are found. All four have no doubt become welded together in a more or less consistent whole, but to understand the whole, the relation of its various parts has to be kept constantly in view. This will explain an apparent contradiction. The last sutta quoted, the Sakaludayi, states that the aim of the religious or celibate life as led in the Buddha's order is the attainment in order of the various things set out in our group. Now, in other passages, other things are stated to be the aim. So here we're talking about what is the fruit of reclusive, of the ascetic life. What are we actually doing it? Are we doing it to realize that group of things we've just seen in the Samanyapala Sutta? In other places, Sanyutta, the Buddha himself represented that the celibate life, brahmacharya, is led by his followers for the sake of complete understanding of pain, dukkha parinya. Further on in the same book, this is repeated three times. And the way of getting there is the Noble Eightfold Path. In Yanguttara, the higher life is said to be the sake of getting rid of, cutting through seven bonds which prevent one from attaining arahantship. Okay, in other places it's for getting rid of five kinds of envy. So Nagasena is therefore quite right. So Nagasena, being the monk interlocutor in the Melinda Panha, which we'll be looking at on Thursday, is therefore quite right when he said that the object of renouncing the world to live in the Sangha is for the sake of righteousness and peace, and in another place that it is to the end that sorrow may pass away. All these explanations belong to the path, not to the rules of the Sangha. They are not really inconsistent with the other aim that our sutta sets out, and they are only additional proof, if such were needed, that it is no more possible to sum up in a single phrase, as some writers have tried to do, the aim of Buddhism or the object of life and the order, than it would be to sum up in a similar way the aim of Christianity or the object for which men enter a Christian order. The aims are necessarily as various as the character and circumstances of the various individuals who take them up. And Nagasena does not hesitate to add, and to add in speaking to a king, that some have joined the Sangha in terror at the tyranny of kings, some in fear of robbers, some because they are harassed by debt, and some perhaps merely to gain a livelihood. This would also apply to other sanghas both in India and elsewhere, and it's quite consistent with our sutta, which only purports to set forth the advantages the early Buddhists held to be the likely results of joining, from whatever motive, such an order, a sangha as their own. Okay? So that's Rhys David's introduction. And, you know, again, just drawing attention to that and having a look at it, and I think even though in some respects outdated, but I think he's still got a remarkable grasp of the Buddhist, the path and the way the suttas work together and so on as a whole. So any questions about that before we move on to the sutta? Okay, so... So for the online text, that will be, I'll be reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, the Samanyapala Sutta. I don't think we have that available online, unfortunately. So we'll have use Tanisaro's translation. Also, I heard on one occasion the Exalted One was dwelling at Rajagaha in Jivaka Komara Bahacha's mango grove, together with a large company of 1,250 bhikkhus. At that time, on the 15th day of Posita, the full moon night of Komadi in the fourth month, King Ajatasattu of Magadha, the son of Queen Videha, was sitting on the upper terrace of his palace, surrounded by his ministers. There the king uttered the following joyful exclamation. How delightful, friends, is this moonlit night! How beautiful is this moonlit night! How lovely is this moonlit night! How tranquil is this moonlit night! How auspicious is this moonlit night! Is there any ascetic or Brahmin that we could visit tonight who might be able to bring peace to my mind? So we have here the very first beginning of the sutta is, I think, one of the most dramatic and beautiful openings for a sutta in the whole of the Buddhist literature. And it's one of the qualities of the Samanyapala Sutta is that it's not only contains beautiful teachings, but its literary qualities are also quite extraordinary. And I think, in many ways, it's the greatest of all the suttas in terms of being a literary product, a literary text. And you see this beautiful setting, and sort of the implications of which only gradually unfold, and which are only hinted at in the sutta itself. So first of all, have the idea that the Buddha is staying in Rajagaha, he's staying in Jivaka's mango grove. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean a lot, you know, to us. It doesn't have that many implications now, but in fact, according to the story, if we know the background to the story, is actually very significant. And we'll go into more detail into the background of the story later on, but but just very briefly, he was staying in Jivaka's mango grove, Jivaka being the doctor of the king. And why is the Buddha staying in the doctor's mango grove? Well, he's staying in the doctor's mango grove because he's sick. Well, he's not sick, he's actually been injured. and he's actually been injured by the rock which was rolled down the hill by Devadatta, who tried to kill him while conspiring with King Ajatasattu. Alright? So that's why he's staying in that mango grove. And so now, it being the observance day, is the Upasita day, as we've discussed. Now the particular full, not just any full moon day, and it's quite rare to find the date specified as precisely as this, the fourth month of the rains, this being a very I think the idea here is that at that time the weather and the sky is very pure. In India and in tropical countries, in the hot season, things tend to get very dusty. During the rainy season, the dust is all kind of settled down by the clouds and so on. But here we're on the fourth month of the rains, it's the end of the rains, so we're moving into the cold season. So it's not actually the monsoon and the rains anymore, but the dust is all settled down, everything's very lush and green, but the sky is very clear and very pure. It's not too hot, not too cold. So this is that time of year, which is the most beautiful time of year often in these places. And the particular month is called the Komadi, which is the water lily, or a kind of lotus, white water lily. This would be the month of Kartika in October or November. The full moon night of this month is called Komadi because it is said to be the time when the white water lily blooms. So we've kind of depicted this as the peak of the most beautiful time in nature, with the sky very clear, the full moon beaming down, the white water lilies out there in blossom and so on. And King Ajatasattu, on this beautiful, tranquil night, is sitting on the top terrace of his palace, surrounded by his ministers. Yes, so you can imagine relaxing up there, sitting quietly in such a beautiful time. And I remember when I visited Rajagaha first time I visited Rajagaha about 1998 or 99 with Ajanyana, and it was actually the full moon in Rajagaha, and it was indeed very beautiful. Most beautiful thing about this passage is everything is set up, yeah? It's got this whole kind of set up, the water lilies, the moon, the king, everyone's sitting there peaceful, and he's saying how wonderful this is, how inspiring this is, how beautiful it is, yeah? I wonder if there's somebody who we could visit that could bring peace to our mind, bring peace to my mind, yeah? There's a whole kind of set up, yeah? Actually, he can't enjoy that beauty, he's actually there. Inside himself, he's full of anguish and torment. Right? And so here, set up this, King Ajatasattu, in a way, this is a very personal story. It's a literal historical story. He'd killed his own father. He had violently ascended to the throne. He'd conspired to kill the Buddha. He was filled with doubt and torment. And his father's already dead. He did, yeah. He'd already died. But that's not mentioned till the end of the sutta. Yeah, so the end of the sutta mentions that. So this whole thing is drawn out. So you have this opening paragraph which sets up this very, very lovely tension. And then the reason for that, and that's sustained through the whole text. And then the reason for it right at the end is brought out that he had killed his father. So again, it's a very, very beautiful literary text. And so it's a very realistic historical description here. But also, King Ajatasattu here is an archetype, and this is setting up a mythic resonance. The king in mythology stands for every person. So the king is somebody who's a decision maker. So the archetype of a king in mythology is the idea of somebody who can make decisions and who has to feel the responsibility of those decisions. Okay, they're not somebody who's being bossed around. So when we're children, for example, we're told do this, do that, and so on, and we're not considered to have full ethical responsibility for our actions. And so in mythology, when a hero goes out and does their adventures and so on, they come back and they become crowned as king. That's like the acceptance of the fact that they've become a mature adult who can make their own decisions they can live their own life and bear the responsibility for that. And so he's the king, and he's made the wrong decision. And so he also stands for every person, every mature person, every adult person, that we're surrounded. We may be surrounded by everything that's beautiful, everything that's wonderful, everything that's auspicious, and yet if we make the wrong decisions, if we don't do good inside ourselves, then all of that will be meaningless. Hard to say. Yeah, hard to say. The fact that it seems to be connected in some way with the story of King Ashoka would tend to suggest that it's less historical, so it's establishing a sort of a mythic precedent for King Ashoka's conversion. So in that sense, but it's used that way. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's invalid. It just means that it's a precedent that was used in that way. I mean, there's certainly, like all the suttas, it's being constructed as a literary text. So, there's the voices of the redactors in there. But personally, I don't think there's any reason to think that it's intrinsically implausible. Ashoka killed all his brothers. Ashoka's father died, and according to various legends, he murdered all of his brothers to ascend to the throne. And then once he was king, he proceeded to murder hundreds of thousands of other people and boast about it. That was before he was a Buddhist. Yeah. So there's this whole idea because he also is the king of Magadha. So it's the idea of the king of Magadha who's committed atrocious crimes to get his power, and then is full of remorse and wants to redeem himself. So you can imagine the people in India. See, we look back and we think Ashoka, a good king, Buddhist, good guy and everything. But you can imagine the people in India in those days, it would have been pretty hard to convince them. I mean, he's just gone and killed hundreds of thousands of people, and he put their heads on stakes to line the road on the way to Kalinga for his victory parade. Right? And then he turns around a little while later and says, "Oh, I'm sorry. I've become a Buddhist now. See, I've gone on pilgrimage to Bodh Gaya, and I'm doing all of these good things, and just forgive me. You know, people might have been a bit cynical." So I think this text has been used implicitly. The implication is, I think, that it's been used in a sense as a precedent for that there can be a genuine conversion. Yeah, that it's not impossible. So I think that may have influenced in some way the formation of the text, but I don't necessarily mean it invalidates the text at all, invalidates the argument.
When you talk about once I heard and I mean I related to the Ananda or the Buddha has heard about what the Buddha was doing or something like that.
Yeah.
But here they're actually relating something before the arrival of something else. Here they're relating something about what the king was doing.
That's right, yeah. Exactly, yeah. So the Buddha wasn't there, Ananda wasn't there, and so on. Yeah. So this is it's a reconstructed literary text based on the story of the king's visit, and you can imagine that if this did happen, that when the king visited the Buddha, that there'd be a lot of gossip, that everyone in the palace and so on would be saying, "Oh, the king went to see the Buddha, what was going on, blah, blah," and so on, and say, "Oh, well, they're all up on the palace roof that night," and so on and so forth. And so the story would get passed around, eventually it gets put into a literary form. Nothing is absolutely anything. It's a good dictum. But I won't go into it too much now, but I'll just show you these two texts here. These, because the Samanipala Sutra is such an important discourse, it's had a lot of studies done on it, and here are two of the best ones. It's Graham McQueen, who's Graham McQueen? Australian. Anyway, Graham McQueen and Conrad Meissig. This one is for Catherine. German. Right. I mentioned before that you've got these two, that the text is basically has two parts, one of which is the story of King Ajatasattu, and the other one is the section on gradual training. So this one, the Graham McQueen study, addresses the story of King Ajatasattu and does a very detailed and excellent comparative study of this, translation of it from all the different versions and historical analysis of the formation. So I'll be having a look at that in future weeks. This one, the one in German, so they published these together as a pair, one of them in English and one of them German. Go figure. The German one by Meissig concentrates on the gradual training part of it and does a comparative study of each section of the gradual training, gives the Sanskrit text, translations from various versions in Chinese and so on, and analysis of that. So I can't read the German, obviously, but I can still read the Sanskrit and have a look and compare the different versions. So anyway, Catherine, if you're interested, to have a look at that. That's pretty heavy going, I have to admit. Very technical. So anyway, that's one of the reasons for choosing this sutta is that over the next few weeks we'll be having a look at some of the different versions and getting a better idea of what may have actually happened, how the text came to be formed, what were the influences that led to creating it in this way or that way. Okay, so the introduction by the king and the response of the ministers. When this was said, one of the ministers said to the king, "Your Majesty, there is Puranakasapa, the leader, Puranakasapa, the leader of an order, the leader of a group, the teacher of a group, well-known and famous, a spiritual leader whom many people esteem as holy. He is aged, long gone forth, advanced in years in the last phase of life. Your Majesty should visit him. Perhaps he might bring peace to your mind." When this was said, the king remained silent. So, this group is the group, famous group of six teachers, and each one is said to be leader of a sangha, and aged, long gone forth, and so on. Now remember that this discourse must be towards the end of the Buddha's life. The whole deal with Devadatta and Ajatasattu and so on probably happened in the last 10 years or so of the Buddha's life. So the Buddha himself was a bit younger than these teachers. And the other minister said to the king, "Your Majesty, there is Makkali Gosala, Ajita Kesakamba, Pakuja Kachayana, Sanjaya Belattaputta, Nigantanataputta, all of whom are the leader of a group, teacher of a group, well-known and famous spiritual leader whom many esteem as holy. Their aged, long gone forth, advanced in years in the last phase of life. Your Majesty should visit them. Perhaps he might bring peace to your mind." When this was said, King Ajatasattu remained silent. Now all this time, Jivaka Kumara Bhacha was sitting silently, not far from the king. And just to give a little bit more background information on Jivaka, he was the, let me have a look in the dictionary of proper names. I don't think the text makes that clear. That's right. There's a bit of awkwardness, yes, exactly. Yes, there's a slight bit of tension. He's saying in the thing, they say that the Jivaka's mango grove is still visible. You can see the remains of it in Rajagaha. Oh, because Buddha's staying in Jivaka's mango grove and Jivaka's treating him for the injury caused by Devadatta, who is the Ajatasattu's ally.
Yes, that's why, because that's when he heard first and he had an idea.
Most likely he does, yeah. I mean, I'd be surprised if he didn't. Yeah, yeah.
He is the king.
He is the king, yeah. Okay, so he's a celebrated physician. He was the son of Salavati, a courtesan of Rajagaha. The Anguttara commentary says that Abhayaraja Kumara was his father. Directly after birth, the child was placed in a basket and thrown on a dust heap from where he was rescued by Abhaya Rajakumara. This is a classic element in the hero myth, the abandoned child who's rescued by another family. Probably when it says that Abhaya Rajakumara was his father, it means his father by upbringing. And so this is, okay, when the question about Abhaya, people said, he is alive, Jivati, therefore the child was called Jivaka, the survivor. And because he was brought up by the prince, Kumarena Posapito, he's called Komarabhacha. Okay, so it means prince reared. It has been suggested, however, that Komarabhacha meant master of the Kaumarabhritya science, the treatment of infants. That's interesting. Perhaps more plausible. And blah, 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 in the Divyavadana he's called Kumarabhuta. So this, of course, the fact that this story is part of the classic hero myth, you think the abandonment of Moses and found in the bulrushes, and just about all the heroes were abandoned at birth and brought up by another family. When grown up, he learned of his antecedents in growing to Takasila without Abhaya's knowledge, studied medicine for 7 years. His teacher gave him a little money and sent him away as being fit to practice medicine. And that story is given in more detail in the Vinaya. And the story of his qualification as a doctor is one of the nice stories in the Vinaya, because it says when he came to be, he finished his studies, his teacher gave him a cart, told him to drive out of the city and drive around and bring back in the evening everything that was not medicine. So he drove out and drove around all day and came back into the city with an empty cart. And his teacher said, you're qualified, you can be a doctor now. Okay, so that's a very beautiful teaching. His first patient was the Sethi's wife, the merchant or millionaire's wife at Saketa, and for curing her he received 16,000 kahapanas, a manservant, a maidservant, and a coach with horses. I think he actually said to her he didn't want any money for curing her, and she gave him that anyway. He returned to Rajagaha by establishing in his own residence there. He cured Bimbisara of a troublesome fistula. Any volunteers? Fistula? Right. We don't want to know. Okay, let's leave it. And received as reward all the ornaments of Bimbisara's 500 wives. Crikey, they wouldn't have been happy. He was appointed physician to the king and the king's women, and also to the fraternity of monks with the Buddha at his head. Other cures of jivikas included that of the Sethi, the millionaire of Rajagaha, on whom he performed the operation of trepanning. So trepanning is literally brain surgeon, cutting open the head and removing something from it, probably a tumor or something. It's said to be like a little being, a little creature that was living inside his skull, possibly a tumor or something. Of the son of the Sethi of Benares, who'd suffered from chronic intestinal trouble due to misplacement, and for this case, Jivika received 16,000 kahapanas. So a lot of those stories found in the Vinaya itself. And then when Chandapajota, which means fiery fury, was ill, Bimbisara lent Jivika to him. Chandapajota hated ghee, which was, however, the only remedy. Jivika prepared the medicine, prescribed it for the king, then rode away on the king's elephant, Bhadavatika, before the king discovered the nature of the medicine. Pajota, in a rage, ordered his capture and sent his slave Kaka after him. Crow, the slave, discovered Jivika breakfasting at Kosambi and allowed himself to be persuaded to eat half a Marabalan, which purged him violently. So Marabalan being the samors, which we have in the on the poster today at Wat Nanachan. So this being a strong laxative. Thank you. Yeah. So that was very tricky. Jivika explained to Kaka that he wished to delay his return. He told him why he threatened the court, and having returned the elephant, proceeded to Rajagaha. Pajota was cured, and as a token of his favour, sent Jivika a suit of Siveyaka cloth, which Jivika presented to the Buddha. Jivika was greatly attracted to the Buddha. Once when the Buddha was ill, Jivika found it necessary to administer a purge, and he had fat rubbed into the Buddha's body and gave him a handful of lotuses to smell. Jivika was away when the purgative acted, and suddenly remembered that he'd omitted to ask the Buddha to bathe in warm water to complete the cure. And the Buddha read his thoughts and bathed as required. Yeah. Most patients don't do what the doctor asks. He did even what the doctor didn't ask. That's good. When the Buddha's foot was injured by the splinter from the rock hurled by Devadatta, he had to be carried away from Madhukuchi to Jivika's Ambawana. There, Jivika applied an astringent and having bandaged the wound, left the city expecting to return in time to remove to it. By the time he did return, the city gates were closed, he couldn't enter. He was greatly worried because he knew that if the bandage remained on all night, the Buddha would suffer intense pain, but the Buddha read his thoughts and removed the bandage. So, this, of course, being the event at our current time. When he became a stream enterer, he would visit the Buddha twice a day, and finding the Vailavana too far away, he built a monastery with all its adjuncts in his own Ambawana, which he gave to the Buddha and his monks. When Bimbisara died, Jivika continued to serve Ajatasattu and was responsible for bringing him to the Buddha after his crime of parricide. Jivika's fame as a physician brought him more work than he could cope with, but he never neglected his duties to the Sangha. Many people afflicted with disease and unable to pay for treatment by him joined the Sangha in order they might receive that treatment. On discovering that the Sangha was thus being made a convenience of, he asked the Buddha to lay down a rule that men afflicted with certain diseases should be refused entry to the Sangha. Jivika was declared by the Buddha chief among his lay followers, loved by the people. He is included in a list of good men who've been assured of the realization of deathlessness. At a meal once given by Jivika, the Buddha once refused to be served until Chulapantika, who had been left out of the invitation, had been sent for. It may have been the preaching of the Jivika Sutta which affected Jivika's conversion. One discussion he had with the Buddha regarding the qualities of a pious lay disciple is recorded in the Anguttara Nikaya. Sirima was Jivika's youngest sister. Interesting. Sirima being the courtesan of Rajagaha. But interesting how they knew he had a sister, but they didn't really know. Anyway, I guess they knew his mum was a prostitute. At Jivika's request, the Buddha enjoined upon monks to take exercise. Jivika had gone to Vaisali on business and noticed their pale, unhealthy look. Alright. So, don't be unhealthy. So that's a summary of Jivika's life. Okay, so we've got up to Jivika. Your Majesty, the Exalted One, the Worthy One, the Perfectly Enlightened Buddha, together with a large company of 1,250... At all this time, Jivika Kumarabhacha sat silently not far from King Ajatasattu. The king then said to him, "Friend Jivika, why do you keep silent?" Okay, so all the other ministers have come forward to make their suggestions. Jivika just keeps silent. And that the theme of silence is a major one in this sutta. Exactly, yeah. Interesting difference, isn't it? So, yeah, silence is a major thing. So, could be a number of reasons why he's silent. I mean, he might have been silent because he thought that Ajatasattu might not have been that happy with him at that time, since he's looking after his enemy. Your Majesty, there is the Blessed One, worthy and rightly self-awakened, staying in my mango grove with a large community of monks, 1,250 monks. A favorable report concerning him is circulating thus. This exalted one is a worthy one, perfectly enlightened, endowed with clear knowledge and conduct, accomplished, knower of the world, unsurpassed, trainer of men to be tamed, teacher of gods and men, enlightened and exalted. Your Majesty should visit the exalted one. Perhaps, if you visit him, he might bring peace to your mind. Okay, so, the offer.
Politically dangerous.
It's quite scary. It is, and that comes out in just in the next passage.
Ajatasattu wasn't
complicit
in the Devadatta's role in the monastery.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought that was like the scheme. Didn't Devadatta indeed try to kill him?
That's true. They work together. He wasn't actually there with the rock, but they were forming the whole scheme right from the beginning together. We'll have a bit more look at that a bit more in detail later. Yeah. I mean, obviously by this time he's wanting to seek redemption. Yeah.
Yes.
So. But we'll have a look more in detail at that story in the next few weeks. So then in that case, have the elephant vehicles prepared, Prem Jivika? Yes, Your Majesty, Jivika replied. He then had 500 female elephants prepared, as well as the king's personal bull elephant, and announced to the king, Your Majesty, your elephant vehicles are ready. Do as you think fit. So this being the... let's just look at some of the... vocabulary being used here. So when it says for those people who may bring peace to my mind or bring happiness is cittang pasideya. Citta is the mind. Pasideya is the verbal form from pasada. So it means make you peaceful, make you happy, but it also means to give confidence and faith. Right? It's a very rich term. And then very good at tunhi ahosi. So tunhi ahosi also remain silent. Now when Jivika's giving his reply, Jivika's also sitting there silent, like the king is silent. And when he asks him why are you silent, why are you tunhi? He calls him Sama Jivika. Sama being quite a familiar term of address, friend Jivika is translated. And notice that with all the others, the description of all the other teachers is the same, that they're the teacher of a group, leader of a group, and so on, and that they're old and aged, and this is their reason for visiting them. Whereas the reason for visiting the Buddha is not because of the fact that he's a great leader, because of the fact that he's famous, it's not because of the fact that he's old, it's because of the fact that he's fully enlightened. And this is the ETPSO formula, of course, which we... regularly. No, it's a different term, yeah. That's sama, yeah. So it's like a familiar term of affection. Not sure. In relationship. Yeah. You'd have to look at the Sanskrit form of it. I'm not sure if it has a Sanskrit form of it. Yeah, I'd have to check that out. I don't think it does. It may do, but I'm not sure. Some other little details here. You notice the terms of reference to the king. So when the text itself in a narrative voice is speaking of the king, he calls him Raja Magadho, the king of Magadha, Ajatasattu is his name, Vedehiputta. Son of the Videhan lady, when he's being referred to by Jivika, Jivika calls him Deva. Okay? Deva down here. Okay, so this is the conventional term of address for a king is Deva, and for a queen is Devi. Okay? Yes, Your Majesty, Jivika replied. He then had 500 female elephants prepared, as well as the king's personal tusker elephant, bull elephant, and announced to the king, Your Majesty, your elephant vehicles are ready. Do as you think fit. And the king, having had 500 of his women mounted on the female elephants, one on each, while he himself mounted his personal bull elephant, with his attendants carrying torches, he went forth from Rajagaha in full royal splendour, setting out in the direction of Jivika's mango grove. When King Ajatasattu was not far from the mango grove, he was suddenly gripped by fear, trepidation and terror. Frightened, agitated and terror-stricken, he said to Jivika, "You aren't deceiving me, are you, friend Jivika? You aren't betraying me. You aren't about to turn me over to my enemies. How could there be such a large company of bhikkhus, 1,250 bhikkhus, without any sound of sneezing or coughing, or any noise at all. And Jivika's response, do not be afraid, great king, do not be afraid. I'm not deceiving you, your majesty, or betraying you, or turning you over to your enemies. Go forward, great king, go straight forward. There are lamps burning in the pavilion hall. Yeah, and you're seeing the suggestion in the first paragraph that he's, you know, he wants someone to find him peace, and now you're seeing exactly how unpeaceful he is. Yeah, he's surrounded, you know, five, and again the motive that he's surrounded by women is also a very interesting one. On female elephants, yeah. Yeah. It's a lot, yeah. Which is just down the road, actually. I mean, it's about as far as Bundanoon is to go from Rajakaha Gate to the mango grove. Is, yeah. Of course, 500 usually always meaning, you know, a great, great number. And, a few details here, but I think that's obviously a very striking image that they're all women on the female elephants. I'm not aware of that image found elsewhere in Buddhist literature. And then of course the question again about silence, yeah? How can the bhikkhus be there, so many bhikkhus, and not making any noise at all of any kind? And the Jivika's response, Ma Bhai Maharaja, Ma Bhai Maharaja. Do not fear, great king, do not fear, great king. And then he says, go forward. He's not betraying him, he's not turning him over to his enemies or anything like that. Go forward, great forward. So this is a very encouraging kind of voice that he's using. And then the particularly interesting thing here is the Ete mandala male dipa jayanti. Those are lamps burning in the pavilion hall. So the pavilion hall here is mandala male. But of course mandala having a very symbolic meaning as well as a hall or whatever, but also meaning the circle of the world. Yeah? And the dipa, the lamps that are burning, but a lamp in Pali, and the Indian usage is not just a light, but also a lamp is a guide. Yeah? So in a way he's saying that the guides are there, that they're shining in the hall. Yeah? But also the word for burning is jayanti, which of course is the verb form of jhana. So one way of translating this is you translate it in a very literal way as saying that in the pavilion halls the lamps are burning, which is obviously the literal meaning of it, but in a metaphorical meaning you can say there in the center of the universe, in the center of the mandala, our guides and teachers are meditating, they're practicing jhanas. So this again is some of the very beautiful literary qualities of this particular text. So then King Ajatasattu, having gone by elephant as far as he could, dismounted and approached the door of the pavilion on foot. Having approached, he asked Jivika, but where, Jivika, is the Exalted One? This is the Blessed One. That is the Blessed One, great king. He is the one sitting against the middle pillar, facing east in front of the company of bhikkhus. Okay, so this again is a phrase that has a dual meaning. On the one hand, it's a perfectly normal question. He's going there, which one's the Buddha? Obviously, he is showing that the Buddha, we discussed this some time ago, that the Buddha is just a normal bloke. Doesn't have any particular, he's not sitting there radiating light of different colours out of his body or anything like that. He's not three times as big as an ordinary person. He doesn't have a big top knot coming out of the top of his head. He just looks like one of the monks sitting there. But also, as a perfectly metaphorical statement on his blindness. He's just been told that the lamps are glowing, they're burning with their meditative, their jayanti, their jhanaing there, but he can't see it. He can't see the light of the lamp. He can see the physical light of the physical lamps, but he can't see the spiritual light of the spiritual lamps. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So this is one of those, one of the many passages in the suttas which show that the Buddha just looked like an ordinary person. King Ajatasattu then approached the exalted one and stood on one side. Notice that he doesn't bow down to the Buddha and so on to start with. He just comes and stands there. As he stood there surveying the company of bhikkhus, which sat in complete silence, as serene as a calm lake, he uttered the following joyful exclamation. May my son, the Prince Udayi Bhadda, enjoy such peace as the company of bhikkhus now enjoys. All right. So again, the motif of silence coming up, and the imagery of the serenity as calm as a lake is reflected in the other imagery which is felt throughout this whole sutta. When we look at, say, the descriptions of the jhanas and other things, we find very similar imagery. We've already heard the imagery of the full moon, that the season when the lotuses are blossoming, the calm of the lake. And so we, all of these are imageries which are the brightness of the mind in jhana and meditation. All of these are images which are set up here in the narrative portion of the text, and which, as the text goes on, are found in spiritual and meditative contexts. So in a way, this is setting up a very distinctively kind of Buddhist idiom or voice in terms of the particular choice of metaphors and symbols. So the Buddha expresses his response to the king's exclamation, have you come, great king, or do your thoughts, great king, follow the call of your affection, being Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. And the king saying, venerable sir, I love my son, the Prince Udayi Bhadda. May he enjoy the same peace that the community of monks now enjoys. So this being, again, I think a very, very lovely exchange here. It's fairly rare to have the Buddha making that kind of question, although you do find it in other places. But this idea of Ajatasattu, who's come, he's seeing that peace of mind which is manifesting in the Sangha, so obviously in their peacefulness and silence. It's the same peace and silence which he could not find within himself. So there's almost like a note of despair. He sort of started out wishing peace for himself, but perhaps he's almost given up on it or something, but he thinks maybe his son might feel that same peace. And of course the irony of this and the drama of this is in the fact that he has just murdered his own father. Yeah, so he's just been the son who's murdered his own father. So his own anguish is because of the fact that he's murdered his own father. And according to the way we'll read the commentary, sets up the story in a very kind of melodramatic way, almost a kind of a soap opera way. When they came, messengers, he tried to kill his father and sent, but then when his son was born, he was so overjoyed to see his son and then reflected, oh, my father must have felt the same when I was born, and then now I've tried to kill him. Yeah? So this is that terrible conflict which Ajatasattu has got himself into. And then the double irony or the triple irony of it all is that Prince Udayi Bhadda ended up killing Ajatasattu. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I hope he's peaceful and doesn't kill me. Yeah.
Well, it
definitely was a common thing. It was endemic.
But kings must have felt very insecure about it.
Absolutely, yeah. And the normal Indian custom was to send your son, when your son became of age, that you would send him away to be like the Raja or the governor of a province. For that reason, so they'd get their experience and so on, and rulership and everything, but they'd also be away from the palace, away from the main centre of power and everything. But this motif of the murder of the king by the prince also is sort of relates to the Fraserian notion of the ritual regicide of the sacred king. So in many cultures, this was not just a random thing where the king was assassinated, but actually became part of the natural cycle, that the king would be slaughtered periodically. And that custom is still practiced down to the 20th century in some places. And, you know, the practice of ritual regicide, which we see as being somewhat barbaric, in fact may have been a very civilizing force, because it means that kings can't stay in power for too long. It means that when there's a succession, one guy dies, but that's all. Yeah, very often succession was accompanied by a huge bloodbath. So it may well have been more civilized to just kill one king rather than the whole court or whatever. So then, bowing down to the Blessed One and saluting the community of monks with his hands palm to palm over his heart, he sat down at one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "I would like to ask the Blessed One about a certain issue, if you'd give me the opportunity to explain my question." And the Buddha said, "Then speak whatever you wish to, great king." Okay, so this being then the actual question on the fruits of the holy life we'll look at later on. So just again, just noticing some of the terminology here, when the Buddha's talking about the king's love for his son, the Buddha uses the word pema. So pema being the usual word meaning like a family affection, love for one's family. And the Buddha, Ajatasattu replies that he's dear to me, he's pia. And the question, and Buddha's response here, when Ajatasattu says he wants to ask a question, and notice the polite way that he puts it, he doesn't just come and give the question, he says, "Sache me bhagava okathan karoti," if the Blessed One will give me the opportunity, panhasa veya karanaya. And so here is the vyakarana. So remember the vyakarana as the one of the angas. So here he's specifically calling it a vyakarana, an answer to a question. And the Buddha says, "Puccha, ask, great king, whatever you wish, yadakankasi." And this is said to be one of the great powers of the Buddha, that they can say that. So it's only Buddhas who can say, "Ask whatever you want and I'll give you an answer." Panhasa. Panha is a question. So panhasa is of a question. So it's the explanation of a question. Yeah, akasa literally means like an opportunity or an opening. Yeah. So it's a polite idiom here. Okasan karoti. Sache me bhagava akasan karoti. If you'd be so kind as to allow me, if you'd be so kind as to permit, something like that. Okay, so then we won't go into the questions today. That's probably enough for one session. So any more questions? Ask whatever you want. Yeah, Samanipala Sutta. So that's in the Samanipala Sutta commentary. Okay. So most of Devadatta's story and of him and the King Ajatasattu and so on is found in the Vinaya. So you can look that up and find the various references there. If you look, you'll find the references. It's found in a few different places in the Vinaya, but you'll find the references, for example, in the Pali Dictionary of Proper Names will give the references. But also in here gives the story according to the commentary. So this is what we'll have a look at next week. We'll have a bit more look at the background of the story of Ajatasattu and Devadatta and the various kinds of extremely dramatic and convoluted stuff that they get into. So maybe for next week. So if you can have a look at those sections in here, on Devadatta and Ajatasattu in the commentary, and also if you get the time to check the various references, I'm sure it gives the references in here. If not, then they'll be in the Dictionary of Pali Proper Names under Devadatta, and Ajatasattu, and you'll find the various discussions, the various canonical versions of the story. Most of it is found in the Sangha-Veda-Khandaka in the Chulavarma. Okie dokie? Okay, let's finish.